All right, great.
All right, let me get set up here and get organized for a second, and we'll get going. Okay, whoa, what a view. You didn't tell me the view was so cool here. Aspiring writers, I love them. It does me good to see so many aspiring writers here, because let me tell you right off the bat, I understand the plight of an aspiring writer. I was in that position for more years than I want to count. A little later on this morning, I'm going to tell you my story, my years as an aspiring writer, so then you'll understand where I've been and the struggles, and so you'll know that I can relate. Now, some of you were here 3 years ago when I spoke, and you heard my story. You don't mind if I tell it again, do you? All right, well, I'll tell it again, but some first-timers here may want to hear it. Okay, so here's proof that I understand the plight of the aspiring writer. I claim that being an aspiring writer is easy, right? How easy is it? Is it as easy as finding a needle in a haystack? No, not quite that easy. Aspiring writers don't have to find a needle in the haystack. They have to find the right blade of hay. And it's not labeled. And when you find one and take it to the farmer, he'll tell you that it's the wrong one, but he won't tell you why. He'll just tell you it doesn't meet our present needs in the farm. Isn't that the way it goes? Then you got to go back and try again. That's how easy it is. Being an aspiring writer is easy. All you have to do is take your manuscript and visit a guru on the mountaintop in the Himalayas. But you have to bring the manuscript written on papyrus and written in blood. Then he'll tell you he's very interested. Okay? Just come back when he's had time to evaluate it. When? Who knows? Just keep coming back. So you climb the mountain every single day. And is it? No, I haven't had time to look at it yet. And finally, after 6 months of checking, you climb the mountain and there's a sign there that says he's been transferred to another mountain. And now you have to resubmit it on notebook paper and number 3 pencil. And now he's only taking zombie romances. Isn't that what it's like? It's easy, right? Being an aspiring writer is easy. All you have to do is avoid adverbs, but still use them. Show, don't tell. But tell sometimes, because showing gets too tedious. Have an agent, because you'll never get published without one. And forget about getting an agent, because you've never been published, right? Isn't that true? Have a speaking platform if you want to get published. How many times have you heard that? But you have to get published to get a speaking platform. Use only the word said in your speaker tags. You ever heard that? Don't ever use anything but said. And don't be repetitive. Don't preach in your stories. You ever heard that? But also make the spiritual message crystal clear without preaching, okay? Foreshadow everything, but also surprise your reader with a bizarre twist. You can do that, right? Use fragments, because they promote a fast pace. But don't use fragments, because they're not real sentences, right, Kathy? Is Kathy? Okay. Use lots of dialogue, because it communicates so well, but don't use lots of dialogue, because it gets tedious. Write a prologue. Don't write a prologue. Have virtuous heroes with lots of sin problems. Isn't that true? And on and on and on. Being an aspiring writer is easy. All you have to do is walk into a blinding snowstorm and figure out which snowflake you're supposed to catch. That's what it's like. You ever feel that way? I did. You hear all these conflicting messages from industry experts, and you have no idea what to believe and what methods to employ. And you often get conflicting messages about how to discern which one's true. Some people will say, just pray and God will lead you in the right direction. And others will say, no. Step out in faith and be bold. And then God will tell you if you're right or wrong. And you just don't, what are you going to do? The contradictions you hear really are like a snowstorm. And you're grasping for frozen flakes, and they just seem to melt in your hands. It feels that way. I know. So I'm another one of those industry experts who dares to tell you his opinion. And it might differ from others that you've heard. Might not. I'm not sure. We'll see. Now, some authors and editors and agents will tell you to study the market. Learn what readers want to read. Figure out what the publishers want to see. What's hot? What's the genre everyone is looking for? You know, a few years ago, everyone was saying, chick lit is hot. Write a chick lit. You know, whatever they call it. Cozy mysteries are selling. Did you hear that one a few years ago? Everyone needs to write a cozy mystery. Write one of those. I heard this week, Amish romance is bigger than ever. The bonnet books, you know, they're all over the place. Will they last? I don't know, maybe. People tell you to write for the market. Don't write for a genre that will get rejected out of hand. That's just foolish. I mean, I've heard that so many times. That's what I was told the years I was trying. You know what they said to me? Don't write fantasy. The Christian market won't accept fantasy, especially a story about dragons. It won't work. It won't happen. Forget it. What would have happened if I had taken that expert advice? Right? Well, you can chase the elusive, ever-changing market. You can chase it. It might work. You might get that publishing contract you've been dreaming about, like a cat chasing its tail. If you finally catch it, you'll learn that it's just a tail. It wasn't what you thought it was. Certainly not the dream that has carried you this far in your journey. Something has gotten you this far, right? Something inside your heart. The market isn't what you're chasing. So this published author is going to give his opinion. Another industry expert. So take it for what it's worth. But I'll tell you, even if taking my advice doesn't make your publishing dream come true, you will never be ashamed of taking it. Okay? You'll never be ashamed. Write to please God, not to please the market. Write your passion, not the reader's expectations. Write what makes you burn with holy fire, not what sizzles through the bookstore checkout lane. Jesus said, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. To me, the formula is simple. If you're a writer, you have a message. If you don't have a message, you shouldn't be a writer. At least, if you don't have a message, I don't want to read what you have to write. Because without a message, you don't have anything to say. And if you're a Christian writer, you should have a message from the Almighty. And writers who seek God's kingdom first will write that message. No matter what it takes, they don't chase after the market. They chase after God's approval. They want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, not congratulations on getting your book published. Both will be nice, but there's one that we want to hear. Well done, good and faithful servant. See, when you write the message that sets your heart aflame, your passion will show on the page. That's what readers want to see. They want to feel the author's heart. You know, for the most part, readers don't care about good writing. Do you know that? For the most part, they don't. They want to be set aflame with the match and the fuel that ignited the author. Now, I'm going to be blunt with some opinions here. So, you know, they're my opinions. Just understand that. So get ready. Do you think The Shack sold millions of copies because of great writing? Hardly. Twilight? Not even close. These are poorly written books. And even though I disagree with the themes and ideas in each one, I can see that the authors were able to grab the readers' hearts. And it made them want to tell other people about their books. The authors were passionate. They were bold. They were unique. They were daring. They didn't chase the market. They established it. You see the difference. I'm not saying that you're excused to write badly. Okay? As long as the passion's there, I can write however I want. You must write with excellence. My point is that the passion must be there first. That's your priority. And excellent writing is our tool to communicate our hearts. Yet we have to make our priorities straight. If we don't have a burning message we can write with passion, we won't get anywhere. No matter how beautiful your prose is, you won't reach anyone. Trust me on this. When you write with passion, your writing will get better. It's just a fact. And when we're able to reach the reader's hearts, we'll deliver a more powerful and more valuable message than Twilight ever could. Instead of showing readers the bloody lust of vampires, we'll be showing them the bloody love of Jesus Christ. Isn't that a greater message? So what are you passionate about? What makes you lament? What makes your heart ache? What joy unspeakable are you jumping up and down to spread throughout the world? And write in your heart, let's see, in your heart, your message needs to be like a cure for a terrible disease that no one else knows about. Your message needs to be like a key that will unlock the chains of prisoners who have no hope. It needs to be clothing for the naked. Your message needs to be vision for the blind. It needs to be solace for the grieving. You have something that you've got to get out of your heart and onto the page. That's what it's got to feel like when you're writing. You can't not write it. Is that how you feel when you're writing? That's how you need to be feeling. So what are you trying to communicate? Is it the message God has given you? Will you act to please Him first? Then let the market do what it will, and write the story that makes you cry. Write the article that draws sweat from your pores. Write the devotional that makes you bleed on the page. Why? Because Jesus wept and sweated and bled for you. That's why. And because He did that, you readers need to know that. And they need to feel it in your writing. As Walter Smith said, there's nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and open a vein. Okay? When you write for the Lord, you write because of the fullness in your heart, not because of the emptiness of your pockets. Take care of the calling God has given you, and God will take care of your pockets. As the psalmist said, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. You see, when you write from the heart, publishers will take notice and your readers will feel it. They'll understand it. Passion was a launching pad for your writer's journey. I think probably every one of you started with passion. Some of you might have been interrupted by the market. Understand? You started with passion. Just as Paul said, are you beginning with the spirit and ending, you know, going on in the flesh? Keep on that journey. Keep on that path. Because it's passion's the fuel that's going to keep you going. If you don't write according to that passion, you're going to run out of fuel. You're going to lose it. You're going to quit. This all started for me about 16 years ago. I was a full-time computer professional, and I felt this gnawing at me. I've always had this passion for reaching people. And as a computer guy, I write programs. They're great. It helps me with the company. But it's not permanent. It's not lasting. I want to do something that's going to last. I want to make a permanent impact. So in our homeschooling, my wife and I have 7 kids, and we've homeschooled them all. They were having trouble with writing. And so I decided, well, maybe if I write a story for them and get them involved. I wasn't much of a writer back then, but I was better than they were, okay? So I was qualified. So I started writing this story for them, and then on Friday nights, my wife would read it out loud to them, and I'd say, okay, kids, what do you think is going to happen next? What do you think the good guy's going to do? What do you think the bad guy's going to do? And they'd give me their ideas, and I'd try to put their ideas into my story. And the next week, she'd read out loud, and they'd hear their ideas come to life, and it got them involved with the storytelling and a love for writing, and it really worked. I mean, my oldest son, who's almost 28, has written a story now. He started back then. He's still working on it. And it's over 10,000 pages long. He loves to write. My daughter Amanda, who's 19, has written 5 novels. She's working on a 6th. And this one story she's written, I am absolutely sure that it is going to be published. In fact, she won Novel of the Year at the Florida Christian Writers Conference, and she's only 19. So it really worked. But what I didn't expect was that this process would ignite a passion in me to write. This is what I've been looking for. I've had this passion to do something permanent for God, and I saw the power of storytelling and how it was affecting my kids and it was affecting me. And, you know, I knew Jesus told stories and how it worked for him, so maybe I could be a writer and get something published and share these passions I have with others. So the story I was writing for my kids grew into a full-length novel, and I decided I'll send it off to publishers. In my complete innocence and naivete, I had no idea that when you send a manuscript to a publisher, the very next step is to get your rejection notice. That's just the way it happens. So what am I doing wrong? Maybe I'm not good enough. I started going to writers' conferences like this one. I started the Florida Christian Writers Conference, and I learned that I had a lot to learn. So over the next 2 years, I continued the process of learning how to write and getting better at writing. Just a quick illustration of how much I had to learn. My very first class was a continuing class on fiction writing. And I was listening to this woman teach, and I was saying, oh, this isn't the right class for me. I don't think this woman knows what she's talking about. So I asked the conference director, Billy Wilson, can I change morning classes? And she said, sure, it's all right, you can. And so then I left Francine Rivers' class. So, yes, I know. We all have a lot to learn, don't we? Anyway, so I got better at writing, and I was on this journey, and I got more rejection notices. I was getting them piled up. Then one night, about 2 years in this process, I had a weird dream about a boy who could breathe fire. And it was a strange dream, and so I always tell my kids about my dreams because I have trouble remembering them, and it's a fun thing to discuss. So I told my oldest son, who was 13 years old at the time, he's almost 28 now, as I said, and he said, oh, that's a cool dream, Dad. You should write a story about this boy who can breathe fire. Then it'd be a lot better than that other stuff you've been writing. Oh, nice kid, right? I said, so why is that? Why would it be better? He said, because then it would be a fantasy story. And I love fantasy. And we're talking about a guy who's now read Lord of the Rings 30 times, okay? He loves fantasy. So we just brainstormed. How do we turn this into a fantasy story? A boy who can breathe fire. Well, how about if his parents are fire-breathing dragons? And that's what my son came up with. And I said, well, that's kind of weird. And he said, but Dad, fantasy is weird. Weird is good. We want to do this. So I said, well, how about if we say his parents used to be dragons and they were transformed into humans and kept their dragon genetics, and then they were able to have a boy who could breathe fire. He said, oh, that's cool. And then we brainstormed until we came up with the concept for dragons in our myths. So I decided I'm going to try to write this story, because as we brainstormed and developed, I could see it in his eyes, and if I want to reach young people, this is the way to go. And in studying the scriptures, I realized, did you know that Jesus told fantasy stories? You ever heard about the camel who passed through the eye of a needle? That's a fantasy story. It can't happen without a miracle. That's all a fantasy story is, something that can't happen without a supernatural cause. So I was convinced I'm going to write this fantasy story. And the more I got into it, the more I realized how powerful this can be. This is exactly the vehicle I need to express my passion. So I finished Raising Dragons in about a year and sent that off to publishers. And you know what they said? No. Now by this time, going to all these writers' conferences, I was getting to know the editors quite well. So now I was getting personal rejection notices. Sometimes you may not want those. And so my rejection notices kept piling up. In fact, you know, we had the little story about T. Davis Bunn getting 50 rejection notices. He's an amateur. Try 200. I got over 200. This is just my in-the-mail rejections or conferences. The email rejections, even more than that. So I got over 200 rejections. Sometimes they're so impersonal, you don't even have the name, your project, no signature, and they can't even cut the paper straight. Thank you for forwarding your material to us. Unfortunately, we found it did not meet our present needs in the book market. Ever heard that before? We appreciate your thinking of us and extend our best wishes for future success. That made me feel warm all over. This is my favorite. In fact, I've shown it so many times I had to put it in plastic. This was at the Mount Hermon Christian Writers Conference back in the year 2000. This was the head editor of the largest Christian fiction publishing house at the time. And he wrote, very creative. I can't disagree that there is a huge general market for fantasy, but I can make an extremely strong and stubborn case that fantasy is unacceptable in the Christian market. An industry expert. What if I had listened to his advice? So, I was stuck. The secular publishers were saying, oh, it's just too Christian. Go to the Christian publishers. And the Christian publishers were saying, it's just too weird. Dragons turning into humans and humans with dragon traits. You know, we want to do prairie romances and bonnet books and, you know. So, I was stuck. But what kept me going? Passion. I could not stop. So, I was piling up all these rejections, and I got to the point where about 8 years ago, I said, God, what am I doing wrong? I'm following your path, and you've given me this holy fire, and I'm submitting, and I'm learning, and I'm training. What am I doing wrong? And I felt like God was saying, I'm glad you asked. Here's the problem. You're writing these stories of adventure and having young people go out, step out in faith, and do dangerous things. And all they have to catch them is their faith in me. And if they fail, if they go off the path in the slightest, they will die. What about you? What happens if you fail? What happens if this publishing journey doesn't work out for you? You have this cushy computer job. You'll be fine. Where's the risk? Where's the danger? Where's your faith? So I was thinking, you know, if I'm teaching young people to step out in faith and do dangerous things for Him, and I'm not willing to do it myself, what does that make me? I want to make heroes. Mine, if I didn't do that, I'd be another H word. You know what that H word is? The hypocrite. So I felt like God was saying, you have the passion. But just like faith without works is dead, passion without sacrifice is dead. I felt like there were two doors in front of me. One was labeled hero, and one was labeled hypocrite. Which one should I go through? Now, of course, I consulted with my wonderful wife. You know, we might have to sell our house. We won't have any income. And you know what she said? Let's do this. Isn't she awesome? And anyway, we get passionate about that. So, I felt like God was saying, it's about time you showed what you believe. So, I quit my job. I had no book contracts. I had 7 kids, big mortgage on a house, and I quit my job. No visible means of support. I was taking that journey, and I was acting on my passions. Well, we did have to sell our house to make ends meet, you know, rent for a while. It was a difficult journey. But you know, when I made that decision, and I said, okay, Lord, I'm going to quit my job, it's all you. I felt like God was saying, good decision. Buckle your seatbelt. I'm going to take you for a ride. So when my books were first introduced, I thought, okay, I quit my job. I got to do something, right? So I heard that it's easier to get published in nonfiction. So what do I know about? I'm a computer geek, but there's thousands and thousands of computer books out there. Well, I'm a dad, and my kids have beaten me into pretty good dad by now. So maybe I could write about being a father. So I wrote 6 chapters on this project called The Image of a Father, 12 of God's fathering attributes and how men can reflect them for their children. And I submitted that at the Florida Christian Writers Conference. And Dan Penwell, who recently passed away, editor at AMG, saw it, loved it, got a contract for it. Yes! This is my first step into the publishing world. But you know, my passion was still this fantasy story. So a month after I got the contract, he called me and said, so I'm in your area, and I'm visiting a friend of mine. Can I come see you? You know, see, meet your family and so forth. So he came to my house and he said, so what else are you working on besides the fathering book? Now, I was almost afraid to tell him. Well, there's this dragon series. Oh, why haven't you ever told me about that before? I said, because you've never done fiction, much less fantasy. We're told not to bother people who, you know, if they wouldn't ever do it. He said, well, that's true, but I'd like to see it anyway. Now, if you haven't been through 200 rejections, you might not realize this, but I think you all can get the feel that after so many years of trying and begging people just to look at my manuscript, now God brings a person standing in my living room saying, let me see your manuscript. So I printed it out. He took it to his publishing house, showed it to another editor. They loved it. You know, they said, this is the best fantasy we've ever seen. But you know, marketing is never going to accept it. What you need to do is come up to Chattanooga. That's where they were. I was in Orlando, Florida at the time. Come up to Chattanooga and pitch it to the publication board for us. So I called up an industry friend and said, have you ever heard of this? And the author gets to pitch it to the board? And he said, no, it never happens. In all my years of experience, that has never happened. I said, okay, great, I'll do it. So, so I went, and for 45 minutes, I talked about my book, and I just poured out my passion. And when I was done, the marketing people were just sitting there slack-jawed. Okay, come back later. And my editor friend Dan said, just go on, see some of the sites. I had two of my kids with me. Come back in the afternoon. I came back, and he said, they said yes. And the reason they said yes, because they said, even if we can't sell them, he'll sell them all out of the trunk of his car. So I got a contract for it. And then when my books were first being introduced, I had the image of a father. Could you give me a copy of that real quick? Yeah. I had the image of a father and raising dragons. If you get me one of those two, please. She's awesome. And this was at the CBA convention. You know, they call ICRS now. Back in 2004 in Atlanta. So I was going to sign books, and I was so excited. I went to the publisher's booth before it opened. Nobody was there except for this old man in a wheelchair. Now, I'd heard I was going to meet the president of the publishing company. I never met him before. His name is Dr. Spiros Zodiadis. Some of you may have heard of him, and he's also passed away since then. And I heard that he was in a wheelchair because of a couple of strokes that he had. So I saw this man, I was wondering if it's him, but I didn't want to, they said they were going to introduce me. But I heard him, he was sitting in the wheelchair looking at some of the books, and his wife was standing next to him, and he said, you know, I don't know why I'm here at the convention this year. I don't have much to do with the company anymore. It'll be interesting to see how God's going to use me, because I feel like he's called me for a special reason. So then I was introduced to him. And he said, oh, I know who you are. I heard about you. You're the person who writes for the young people. And I heard that you quit your job to pursue this full time and that you don't know where your next paycheck is coming from. He's reminding me of my story. And then suddenly he stopped talking and his eyes grew wide. And he started clapping his hands. He said, oh, my brother, now I know why God has called me to this convention. God has called me to give you a word. The word is autarkeia. It's a Greek word. It means sufficiency. It means contentment. It's from 1 Timothy 6:6, where it says, godliness is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. It's also Philippians 4, where Paul says, I've learned to be content in all my circumstances. God wants you to know that he is your sufficiency. Be content. All will be well. So that's a great word. So this word was on my mind, autarky. I hadn't had any income in a year at that point. Zero, nothing. So it really hit home. About 2 weeks after that, I went to a homeschoolers conference in Montgomery, Alabama. I was thinking, I'm a homeschooling dad, and homeschoolers buy a lot of books. They network well. This would be a great place to get into the market. So I rented the exhibit table and all the lodging. And, you know, I knew all these expenses were coming on, even though I had no money. So I want to be a good steward of God's money. That's all. That's good and proper. So I was keeping close track of my expenses. So I said, if I break even the selling books versus expenses, then I'll know this is something God wanted me to do. That's fair, because I want to make sure I'm doing the right marketing. I took my daughter Amanda with me, and so she was helping me. And while I was selling books, I was keeping a close tally on the books I was selling. Now the problem is, now I can say this because I'm a homeschooler. homeschoolers are suspicious of everything, okay? Montgomery, Alabama homeschoolers, they got that all over. The girls all had long skirts, the boys with the button-up shirts and the ties, and they saw these dragon books on the table, and some were making a wide berth around the table going, "What is that?" So I wasn't selling very many books. So at the end of the first hour, I had my tally of books, and I was thinking, okay, I know how much money I'm making per books and how many books I sold. I know how many hours are in the convention, so I can do an extrapolation and project how much money I'm going to make, right? I'm a math geek. I can do this. So I calculated my expenses versus profits, and if this keeps up, I'm going to be $50 short of breaking even. That's not good. I want to break even. So I thought, I got to sell harder. I got to work harder. I'd go out, come look at my book, and people would run away from me. Please. And now during this time, these two girls kept coming by my table, and they were both handicapped. One was severely handicapped in a wheelchair. Her limbs were bent and twisted, and her back was bent, and her head was oversized for her little body. And the girl pushing her in the wheelchair was also handicapped, but not as badly. Her hands were clubbed. Her feet were way turned in, but she could walk, and she'd push her friend around. They'd come by my table, and they'd be the sweetest little angels. "We're both 9 years old, and we're going to be best friends. We're both going to be 10 years old this month." And they tried to look at my books with their little gnarled hands. They were just beautiful. So when I saw the little girl in the wheelchair, it reminded me of Dr. Sodiades in the wheelchair. And the word, autarkia, I was thinking, this girl is a picture, a living illustration of autarkia. Think of it. How many surgeries has she had? How many times has she wanted to go out and play with the other children, but she couldn't because of her handicap? Maybe she's even been mocked for what she looks like. But this smile on her face, autarkia, contentment, God is my sufficiency. God has brought me a living illustration of this word. I've got to pay attention to this, right? Okay, I will. So they'd go off, and I'd go back to my sales and my calculations. And every hour, I would calculate. Same rate of sales, same result. I'm going to be $50 short of breaking even. Again and again and again, same result. Second day of the conference, last few minutes, a man and I are literally packing up our books. And there's a man at the end of the table who's looking at the fathering book. And he was taking his time, and I was thinking, okay, it's time to go. And so finally, he closed the book and said, "This would be good for my men's ministry, I'll buy it." So when he paid me, started walking away, and I looked at the money, I was thinking, okay, this is the last money I'm going to get. I can make an exact calculation. So I figured real fast, yes, I'm going to be $50 short of breaking even. Put it in the money box. Well, I guess I won't do this again. This was a failure, right? Now the man was walking off, he suddenly stopped. And he looked at the book as if looking at it for the first time. He said, "Brian Davis wrote this book." I said, "Yes." And he turned around, and there was my sign on the wall, said, "Brian Davis, author." He said, "Are you Brian Davis?" And I said, "Yes." Then suddenly he started shaking, and his face turned red. And he walked up to me and said, "You're going to think this is really weird." I said, "It's all right. What is it?" He got his wallet out again, and he said, "On my way over here, God told me to find a man named Brian and to give him $50. And he had two 20s and a 10 in his hand. And I was so shocked. I started shaking. I said something dumb like, "Oh, I don't know what to do." And he just extended the money farther and said, still shaking, "God commanded me to give you this. Will you take it?" What could I do? I took it. So when I got home, I just had to check. I calculated all my expenses, calculated all my profits, and when I added the $50, I broke even exactly to the dollar. What does that mean? What does that mean? Oh, the voice came back to me and said, "Remember what I told you? Buckle your seatbelt, buddy. I'm going to take you for a ride." And that was just the beginning. Now, then I said, "Okay, God, if you're my sufficiency, if you're my provision, I'm going to trust you for everything, even my ideas for my stories." And I was stuck once with Enoch's Ghost. It just wasn't working very well. This is book number six in the Dragon series. Actually, number two in Oracles of Fire. And so I said, God, I need a story. Help me out. Well, this was back in 2006. My father was suffering from a severe brain disease. It was so bad, it took him from perfect health to death in just 6 months. And this was September 2006, and he was getting real bad. He lived in Tallahassee, Florida. I lived in Orlando, Florida. And so he was already bedridden, couldn't walk, and he would go in and out of a dreamlike state. So I took my wife and my three daughters who were at home at the time, and we drove to Tallahassee to visit him, watched a football game together, and he was lucid enough so we could have a good time, even though he would go in and out of a dreamlike state. The next morning, we were getting ready to leave. We're in his bedroom, and he was in bed. And as we were saying goodbye, he said, "So, son, what are you going to do about the 12? I said, "The 12? The 12 what?" He said, "The 12 people." And then I realized he was in one of those dreamlike states. So I said something like, "I don't know, Dad. I'll try to figure it out." And then he shook his head and said, "I'm sorry, son. I don't know what I was talking about." He was coming out of the dreamlike state. So we said goodbye, and I stopped at the first gas station on the way home and to fill up with gas. It was only a couple blocks away. And I filled up with gas, and when I opened the door to get back in the car, you might not be able to see this, but I have a dime and two pennies. Okay? On the ground, right by the car, was this dime and two pennies, 12 cents. Immediately thought, just 3 minutes ago, my father said, "What are you going to do about the 12? So I picked it up, got in the car, and showed it to my wife. I said, "You heard what my father said, but you know what's really weird about this? When I filled up with gas yesterday to drive up to Tallahassee, the same thing happened. I found a dime and two pennies right by the car. I didn't think about it until now." And then I said, "That's 2 days in a row." And my wife shook her head. She said, "No, that's 3 days in a row." Because the day before that, Hannah's my youngest daughter, Hannah and I were at the Walmart, and she found a dime and two pennies right by the car in the Walmart parking lot. 3 days in a row. Then it hit me that when my father said, "What are you going to do about the 12? It had already happened twice when he said that. So I was thinking, has God given me an idea for my story? That was the first thing that came to my mind. Yeah, you know, and so my father's voice was echoing, "What are you going to do about the 12? What are you going to do about the 12? And my answer was, "I have no idea." So I got to pray about this. I got to think about this. Well, over the next several weeks, finding a dime and two pennies happened 7 more times. You know how you find a penny on the sidewalk? Not me. It was always a dime and two pennies. It could be in the grocery store bathroom, the hiking path in the middle of a forest. What's going on here? This is nuts. So now we're into December, and my wife and I had to take my son Caleb to the airport really early in the morning, something like 5 in the morning. He had to go to Chicago. And so on our way back, we passed by this park where we do our 3-mile prayer walks in the morning. And I said, "Well, it's dark, it's deserted, it's earlier than we usually go. But we're here, let's go ahead and do a prayer walk." Now, in Florida in December, you can go for a walk at 5 in the morning, okay? It's all right. So, and it was also well lit. There were street lamps all around. So as we were walking along, picture this sidewalk with a street lamp, and it's got a circular glow right in the middle of the sidewalk. And as we're coming up, this is a dime, right in the middle of the right in the middle of that glow, right in the center, there's this shiny dime. We were walking up, we saw at the same time, we just stopped. There's a dime, yeah. So I was on this side, my wife was on this side, and as she bent down to pick it up, I just laughed and said, "So where are the two pennies, right?" And when she got down real low, she said, "Well, they're right over here." And there they were in the shadows where I couldn't see them from where I was. And later she admitted to me, she said that she literally looked for the two pennies because she knew they had to be there somewhere. That's the way it was getting. So I said, "Okay, this is it. I've got to figure this out." Now, as a full-time author, I can make whatever schedule I want. So I said, "I'm going to dedicate this day to figuring out the mystery of the dime and two pennies." So I went for a long run. I do my best thinking when I'm running. I was thinking, maybe it's this. No, that doesn't work. Maybe it's that. No, it doesn't work. So when I got home, my wife met me at the door. So I said, "I have some ideas. Maybe we brainstorm." She said, "No, I have to tell you what happened while you were gone." Hannah was looking for her wristwatch, stopwatch, that she uses to time her music practice. She couldn't find it. Looked under the bed, rummaged through the closet. She found this old purse that she hadn't seen in months. She opened the purse. What do you think was in the purse? Diamond two pennies. And that's all that was in the purse. Nothing else. But what was weird is that it was a silver dime and two old wheatback pennies. You ever seen those? All three coins were over 50 years old. She had no access to coins like that. But you know something? My father was a coin collector. So it was like it came all the way back saying, remember who first asked you, what are you going to do about the 12? What are you going to do about the 12? Then it hit me, these old coins. It hit me just like a ton of bricks. I know what it means. I figured it out. Suppose you want me to tell you, don't you? Well, Moses sent 12 spies into the promised land. 10 of them came back with this report. There are Nephilim in the land, and we look like grasshoppers in their sight, and there's no way that we can go into this land. There were 10 of them, and there were 10 cents and a dime. And they brought back a report that might have been factually true, but it was fearful. It lacked faith. You know, people who are fearful and lack faith and who are unwilling to sacrifice and go into danger for God's sake, they're easy to find, aren't they? They're all over the place. There's an old saying, there's an idiom about a dime, about things that are cheap and easy to find. Does anybody know what it is? Dime a dozen. People who are faithless and fearful, they're all over the place. They're like a dime a dozen. The 10 faithless ones. The dime. There were two who brought back a different kind of report, and they were, anybody? Joshua and Caleb. They said, yes, there are Nephilim in the land. Yes, we look like grasshoppers in their sight, but so what? We have Jehovah God who's going to go and do battle for us. This land is flowing with milk and honey. Let us go now. This is the promise. Let us sacrifice ourselves. Let us be willing to die for this passion. People like that are rare. Two pennies. Two faithful witnesses. Now, I had something with a dime, but what about these coins, two pennies? Well, I figured that out too. But you know, Jesus was once in the temple, and people were bringing in their offerings from their surplus, and an old widow came in, and she laid down two copper coins. And Jesus declared them to be more valuable than all the others. Why? Because this is all she had. She put down those two copper coins and said, God, I don't know where my rent's coming from. I don't know where my next meal's coming from, but you have called me to give these to you. I trust in you. And ever since that day, two copper coins has come to represent being willing to give everything and trusting God for everything else. It's all yours. So the widow did that. Joshua and Caleb did that. I did that when I quit my job. So now, in my story, in the previous book, I already had Nephilim in the story. This is going to be great. So all I had to do was have 10 people who should have had the power and the faith to conquer these giants, but because of their fear and unwillingness to sacrifice, they wouldn't. And I had my two weakest heroes who, because of their faith, were able to defeat the giants. And I also had one character, this girl who had two wonderful traits, two wonderful gifts from God, who had never been willing to sacrifice them to God by faith, and even represented them in the story by two pennies. And when she surrendered them to God, it made all the difference in the world. So it worked. And now whenever anyone reads that story or hears me tell this story, and I tell this story to thousands of kids all over the country, I ask them, what are your two copper coins? Some of you have already given those two copper coins, and you are on this journey, and you're doing it. But some people still have not surrendered them. What are your two copper coins? And the story worked beautifully. Some people tell me that book's my best book. But now, you know, when I figured it out, when I figured out the mystery of the diamond two pennies, it stopped happening. I didn't see them anymore. It just quit until this year. I was running in Florida in my mother's house, the widow, and I ran across, I saw this dime as I was running. So I said, I'm going to go get that dime on my way back. So on the way back, picked up the dime, and guess what was right by the dime? 2 pennies. And I took them into my mother and said, I think these are for you. Anyway, so when the passion is accompanied by the sacrifice and by the faith, God will honor it. Passion is proven by the sacrifice. The flame within is proven by the flame without. Isn't that true? So, what would have happened if I had failed to get published? I would have done exactly what I was called to do. I'd have done the same thing. Maybe I never would have had a book on the shelf. But I still would have heard those precious words. Well done. Good and faithful servant. That's what I wanted to hear. If I had chosen the markets course and managed to get published that way, I would have had my book with a name on it. With my name, it would have been on the bookstore shelves. But you know what it would have been? A cat's tail. Warm and fuzzy. But all it would have done was tickled my fancy, stroked my ego. That's all it would have been. During the 8 years I sought publication, this was my cry, and I'll quote it here. God, my goal is not to get published. I want to burn for your glory. I want the words you have given to me to reach into hearts and transform them into holy torches. Take my flame and ignite my readers. But since you have given me this passion, I need you to open the doors that lead the way to getting your message into their hands. Here's my passion. Jeremiah 7, verse 3 to 11. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words, saying, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly practice justice between man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, nor walk after other gods to your own ruin, then I will let you dwell in this place. In the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, you are trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and offer sacrifices to Baal, and walk after other gods that you have not known? Then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, that you may do all these abominations. Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? Behold, even I have seen it, declares the Lord. A den of robbers. What did Jesus say when he cleansed the temple? The same thing. Did he have passion? Did he prove that passion? This is my passion. I weep, sweat, and bleed for the people who are called by the name of Jesus to live according to that calling. So I write about holiness. I write about sacrifice. I want to infuse in readers a vision of complete surrender to God to the point of being willing to die. That's what heroes are all about. I want readers to understand that God's grace includes the power to serve Him in confidence, in courage, in conduct, that we can unfailingly walk in His path by the power of the Holy Spirit that He provides. This fire has burned inside me for 27 years without a day of rest. So when I sit to write my story, I can't do anything but sweat and bleed and cry over these manuscripts. The readers see it and feel it. I know, they tell me they do. And I hope the flame does more than just scorch their conscience. I hope it ignites a cleansing inferno that never fades away. So if you choose this path of writing your passion, rather than chasing the market, sometimes your journey might appear to be dark and lonely, but you'll never be forsaken. My story proves that. With every word you write to God's glory, you'll feel His pleasure. As you knock on the publisher's doors, you'll do it with confidence, not in fear of being rejected. It'll be up to God to open their hearts. You're not a cat chasing her tail. You're a conduit for God's purposes. And by faith, you'll leave it up to Him to take care of the rest, make His blessings flow through your words. It's up to God, as long as you're writing for Him. I'm going to read a sample from my book, The Candlestone, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, my passion, and how it comes through. Our heroine, Bonnie, is a faithful Christian girl who has dragon wings, and she is praying for a boy her age who also has a dragon trait, a he's able to breathe fire. So as I read, I hope you'll see that I'm writing my passions without concern for the market's expectations. Like they say, don't preach. Well, get ready. Okay? Writing with passion allows me to write fearlessly, and readers embrace fearless writing. Bonnie is praying for Billy. Dearest Heavenly Father, my heart longs for your presence, for you to sit by my side and whisper in my ear. Grant me counsel, the deep wisdom that listens to my heart and understands my pain in the midst of my groanings. I have a friend who stands as close as a brother, a brave soul, yet you know him better than I. He is Billy Bannister, the son of Clefspear, a dragon. I have seen in him the heart of a warrior, a knight squire who follows the code, ready to die if need be to slay the forces of evil and rescue vulnerable maidens, broken-hearted widows, and grieving orphans. He is gallant, loyal, and true, sacrificing his esteem, forfeiting his comfort, even spilling his blood. But what color is his soul? Tell me, Father, holy and true, I have borne in my heart this ache for so long. My dear friend has a desperate need, and I have seen it. How can I be his accuser, condemning the one who has gladly poured out his blood in my stead? But shall I deny my witness? There is a darkness, a gnawing void behind those eyes of steel, and even in those placid pools I see turmoil, uncertainty, even pride. Oh, how can love and vexation so violently mix, a brew of man and beast stirred in a cauldron of scales and flesh? Yes, there is violence, a rage that does not rest, for he battles in the fields of his mind, resolutely standing his ground, his faith in the old ways, the ways of the code, the ways of the dragon, the ways of his father. Yet his father has left him an orphan, a squire without a knight, and the cruelty of his passing has never ceased to consume his standing as he guzzles from the old wineskins from which he relies. It is not a slayer who haunts his thoughts and dreams. Dare I ask it? Shall I be so bold? Is it you, my father, the pursuer of men's souls, who brings war to his battlefield? Are you the fire that will purge his pride, his reliance on things of the world, honorable deeds, yet filthy rags in your sight? Will you teach him what pleases you? Will you tell him about weapons from above, the sword of truth and the shield of faith? Will you give him new wineskins, pouring into his heart the wine from above, the blood of the sacred covenant? Will you make him a knight, dressed in holy raiment, fit to take a seat at your table? I fear the battle, Lord, lest you slay him with penetrating light, driving your two-edged sword deep into his fragile bosom and searching out the dark recesses of his heart. For who can stand when your word declares judgment? How will he survive unless someone takes him to wash in the river, the wellspring of eternal life? Who am I? How can I take him to your fountain? You know him far better than I, yet I feel I know his heart as well as my own. From dragon to dragon, I feel when he is near, as though his heart pounds in my own breast. When he touches me, the heat of his passion and the fire of his breath spread warming flames all around this cold orphan's crying soul. Yet I am not his counselor, nor his judge. I stand as one who bears a gift, but knows not how to give it. For though I am emboldened in my closet, in his presence I melt like wax. Dear Father, I confess that I love him. Yet how little I understand those words. We are bound by prophecy, destined for oneness, and this virgin's heart quakes at the thought. My heart longs for his, yet I know we cannot be one until the sun chases away his shadows. For light and darkness can have no fellowship. Oh, Father, whisper now in my ear. Shall I tell him of your saving grace? If I do, will he respond to you or to his passions? Would my feminine voice distract him from hearing yours? Would my face be his vision, or would he see the face of Christ? Oh, Father, should such a maiden take this duty to tell a heroic soldier that his scarlet soul needs to be made white? And now, Heavenly Father, I ask you to take my entreaty and use it as you will. Whether in a whisper, a shout, or a song, let my voice be yours. Let my words be your balm. Use them to soften his heart, that you may inscribe your name there with indelible blood enlighten his mind, that truth may reside there forever. Cleanse his soul with fire and water, burning away the old and washing away the scarlet stain, that your spirit may indwell, empower, and preserve. Whatever must be done, whatever pain you must bring to make red into white, I pray that you will make the mortal squire into a holy knight. So, that's my prayer for you, that you'll feel that passion, that you will be able to bleed onto those pages. You won't need to wander in a blizzard, chase your tail, because you'll be marching down a well-lit path, following the Savior who blazed the trail for you. You'll be painting a picture of a Holy Father, a loving Savior, and a forever present Spirit. You have the key to the chains. You have the cure to the disease. You have sight for the blind, and you are called to deliver these priceless treasures. Imagine that. You're the carrier. What a calling. What a joy. What an incredible opportunity. If that doesn't set you ablaze, I don't know what will. If you hold it back, the flame will either go out or will burn inside you until you can't endure it any longer. As Jeremiah said, but if I say I will not remember him or speak any more in his name, then in my heart it becomes like a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary of holding in, and I cannot endure it. Let it blaze. Let it pour out like a flood. Then and only then will you understand that you, as an aspiring writer, are among the most blessed people in the world. For you have been called to deliver a message that will set people free. May God bless you as you ignite the readers with his holy flame. Thank you.